comfortable for you. Call our pledge line right now at 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. That's the number to call. You could become that first-time subscriber to WBAI. How about that? You've been listening to Democracy Now! For a while, and you want to support this radio station. Commercially free. No commercials at all. Again, made possible by listeners just like you. Call the pledge line right now at 212-209-2950. We can do this together. You and I. You and all of us here at WBAI. 212-209-2950. It's 9 a.m. and coming up next, Law and Disorder.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Marjorie Cohn details Israel's recent raid on seven leading Palestinian human rights organizations.
In spite of condemnation by hundreds of human rights organizations around the world, the Biden administration refuses to speak out against the raids.
We'll also take a look at one of the most pervasive forms of censorship in the United States.
That would be book banning, and it's on the rise at high school and college campuses, according to our guest, Chris Finan.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
On August 18th, the Israeli military raided the offices of seven leading Palestinian human rights and civil society organizations, ransacking and shuttering them. 3 days later, the Israeli occupying forces summoned the directors of two of the groups for interrogation. Last October, Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz reported that Israel had baselessly designated six of the groups as, quote, terrorist organizations because they had links to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, or PFLP, a leftist political party with a military wing. In November, the Israeli military commander in the occupied West Bank declared the six to be, quote, unlawful associations. But in the ensuing months, Israel has failed to come forward with competent evidence that links the six groups to the PFLP. A new classified report from the CIA says it could find no evidence to support the terrorist designations. Progressive organizations in Israel and the United States condemn the raids. But the Biden administration has refused to denounce them, stating that it is awaiting further information from Israel. Law and Disorder co-host Marjorie Cohn is interviewed today about the ramifications of the terrorist designations and recent raids on the organizations. She is professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and a member of Jewish Voice for Peace and the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. Marjorie, welcome to the other side of the microphone.
It's great to be with you, Heidi.
What are the six Palestinian human rights groups that were designated as, quote, terrorist organizations, and what did they do?
Adamir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association provides legal support for Palestinian prisoners, and it documents arrests and administrative detentions and works to end torture and other violations of prisoners' rights. Al-Haq is the leading Palestinian human rights organization that seeks accountability for Israeli war crimes in the International Criminal Court. The Union of Agricultural Work Committees has played a critical role in confronting illegal Israeli settlement expansion and the theft of Palestinian farmers' land. It advocates for sovereignty over natural resources in the face of the climate crisis, and it promotes sustainable farming. Defense for Children International Palestine is the only Palestinian human rights organization dedicated to the rights of children. It investigates, documents, and exposes human rights violations against children in Israeli military detention, and it provides legal services for them. The Union of Palestinian Women's Committee helps empower Palestinian women to achieve economic independence and counter gender discrimination, and it provides legal and psychological support for women. And the Bison Center for Research and Development is a community resource that develops youth programs and helps Palestinians assert their socioeconomic rights.
What about the seventh group that was raided and shuttered?
Yes, that is the Health Work Committees, and it provides health services and helps the poor and marginalized obtain social rights.
Marjorie, why do you think the Israeli government targeted those groups?
Because of their support for BDS, which is the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, and the prosecution of Israel in the International Criminal Court. BDS is a nonviolent movement all over the world aimed at ending the illegal Israeli occupation, and it has received support, as I said, worldwide. In 2021, the former chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court announced that the ICC had launched a formal investigation into war crimes committed in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, since Israel's 2014 Operation Protective Edge. And Benny Gantz was head of the Israeli military when it killed 2,200 Palestinians, including at least 1,492 civilians, 437 of them children. Gantz later bragged that he had sent Gaza back to the Stone Age. The ICC is also investigating Israel's building of illegal settlements in occupied Palestinian territory. The Fourth Geneva Convention prohibits the transfer by Israel, which is the occupying power, of its own civilians onto occupied Palestinian land. And the director of one of the six organizations that was designated so-called terrorist, Al-Haq, said that they had crossed, Al-Haq had crossed the red line when it provided assistance to the ICC's investigation of Israeli war crimes. His attorney said it all starts and ends with the fact that these organizations are seen as promoting a boycott of Israel and the investigation of war crimes in the International Criminal Court. The attack on them is a political one under the guise of security.
I understand that the six designated organizations issued a joint statement in response to the raids. What did it say?
It said, and I quote, "Israel's unlawful and aggressive incursion poses an existential threat to Palestinian civil society. The attack seeks to dismantle crucial mechanisms that work to uphold human rights and end Israel's settler colonial and apartheid regime, which systematically denies the Palestinian people their right to self-determination and the right of refugees to return," unquote. The groups decried the, quote, "failure of the international community to take meaningful concrete actions to hold Israel accountable for designating the organizations as grave violations of international law," unquote.
Marjorie, how did NGOs in Israel and the United States react to the raids?
Well, B'Tselem, which is the premier Israeli human rights organization, said that it stands in solidarity with the raided organizations. And it said, quote, "We will continue to work with our colleagues in the Palestinian NGOs to dismantle the apartheid regime. This regime considers violent repression a legitimate tool to control Palestinians, yet defines nonviolent civil activity as terrorism," unquote. Progressive organizations in the United States urged the Biden administration to condemn Israel's attacks on the Palestinian NGOs. NGOs are non-governmental organizations. The Center for Constitutional Rights said that Israel's, quote, "physical assault on the prominent Palestinian civil society organizations must be urgently condemned by the Biden administration in the strongest terms, with concrete actions in response to the criminalization of human rights defenders to follow," unquote. Jewish Voice for Peace expressed solidarity with the targeted groups, saying, quote, "Silencing human rights organizations will put millions of Palestinians in even more danger. This egregious attack by the Israeli government on human rights defenders is the latest in decades of attacks on Palestinian civil society. Silencing and intimidating human rights organizations is a classic tactic of states trying to avoid accountability for their war crimes. We stand with and will continue to work alongside the brave groups that are working to support Palestinians and expose Israeli apartheid," unquote. And Jewish Voice for Peace urged that Congress take action. They said, quote, "The Israeli government is openly and blatantly working to erase documentation and exposure of its violent apartheid regime, a regime that the U.S. funds with $3.8 billion every single year. We desperately need members of Congress to start speaking out now," unquote. The National Lawyers Guild wrote a letter to Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, saying, quote, "The U.S. must act immediately to stop Israel's rapidly advancing attack on Palestinian civil society. Much of the work of these organizations involves monitoring and documentation of human rights violations. This work is vital given Israel's policy of prohibiting international investigative bodies from accessing the occupied territory," unquote. And the National Lawyers Guild stated that, quote, "The State Department must comprehensively review the entirety of Israel's human rights records in light of the Foreign Assistance Act, which prohibits providing assistance to a country that engages in a systematic pattern of human rights violations," unquote. And just before our interview, I came across a list of more than 200 organizations worldwide that condemned Israel's raids and shuttering of these Palestinian human rights organizations. And I'll just give you a few examples. I don't want to go through all 200, but Committee for a Just Peace in the Middle East, Episcopal Peace Fellowship Palestine-Israel Network, Penn International, Physicians for Human Rights Israel, the Canadian BDS Coalition, Human Rights Watch, BDS Netherlands, BDS Vancouver, Belgian Campaign for Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, Center for Constitutional Rights, Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid, and the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm curious, Marjorie, did countries in Europe oppose the raids as well?
Yes, the foreign ministries of France, Belgium, Denmark, Germany, Ireland, Italy, the Netherlands, Spain, and Sweden issued a joint statement saying that no substantial information had been received from Israel that would justify designating the groups as terrorist organizations. The raids are not acceptable. We stand firm with NGOs to uphold the right to freedom of expression and association in the occupied Palestinian territory. And Heidi, I should add that Amnesty International said, quote, these organizations have contributed enormously to human rights in the occupied Palestinian territory and across the globe, yet Israeli army boots trample all over their work. Amnesty International stands proudly in solidarity with our Palestinian partners and calls on all governments to condemn the Israeli army's attack on Palestinian civil society, unquote. And Amnesty International noted that Israel's treatment of the Palestinians constitutes grave breaches of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which amount to war crimes and forms part of the system of apartheid that oppresses the Palestinians. And Human Rights Watch said the raids constituted an attack on the global human rights movement, adding, quote, Palestinian civil society today faces an existential threat, unquote.
Let's go back to last fall. After the six groups were designated as, quote, terrorist, how did international human rights bodies respond?
Well, on February 23rd of this year, United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet condemned Israel's decision to designate these groups as terrorist, calling it, quote, an attack on human rights defenders, on freedoms of association, opinion, and expression, and the right to public participation, unquote. And she said, quote, it should be immediately revoked, unquote. And she noted that the targeted groups were, quote, some of the most reputable human rights and humanitarian groups in the occupied Palestinian territory, and for decades have worked closely with the UN, unquote. Bachelet said the terrorist designations, quote, raise serious concerns that they are being used to halt, restrict, or criminalize legitimate human rights and humanitarian work, unquote. And she said that these terrorist designations, quote, were based on vague and unsubstantiated reasons, unquote. And her office, quote, was not aware of any credible evidence to support those accusations, unquote. Then on March 30th, the UN Human Rights Committee, the body that administers the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, said that the use of secret evidence for these terrorist designations violates the right to a fair trial. And on April the 25th, 12 UN human rights experts called on the international community to publicly conclude that Israel had not substantiated its terrorism allegations against the six groups, to resume, continue, and increase financial support to those groups, and to demand that Israel retract the terrorist designations and cease the harassment of Palestinian, Israeli, and international human rights organizations. They, quote, strongly and unequivocally condemned, unquote, Israel's designation of Palestinian human rights defenders as terrorist organizations. And they said, quote, this designation is a frontal attack on the Palestinian human rights movement and on human rights everywhere, unquote. And the experts added, quote, silencing their voices is not what a democracy adhering to well-accepted human rights and humanitarian standards would do, unquote.
Local Call, +972, and The Intercept obtained the classified dossier from the Israeli security agency Shin Bet, on which these designations were based. What did that classified dossier say?
Well, in an effort to convince European countries to stop financing these organizations, the human rights organizations, Israel sent the security force Shin Bet's dossier to representatives of at least seven countries and the European Union in May 2021. And in at least five of those countries, senior officials said that the dossier contained no concrete evidence and they would thus continue to fund the organizations. The Dutch foreign minister and the Belgian Belgian Economic Development Minister publicly stated that the dossier did not contain, quote, even a single concrete piece of evidence, unquote. The three organizations, Local Call, Plus 972, and The Intercept, obtained the 74-page classified Shin Bet dossier together with hundreds of pages of Hebrew summaries of Shin Bet and Israeli police interrogations of Palestinian accountants Amro Hamouda and Saeed Abdat, who had worked for a different Palestinian human rights organization. Abdat endured 32 interrogations, sometimes for 22 hours straight. He was subjected to the, quote, Shaba position, unquote, S-H-A-B-A-H, where his legs were tied and his hands were bound behind his back, causing severe pain. And Abdat's attorney said his client fainted several times, and Shin Bet interrogators then poured water on him and refused to provide medical treatment. They threatened to arrest his wife and family. Nevertheless, this dossier, based upon this torturous interrogation, these torturous interrogations, did not provide evidence to support the terrorist designation. And by the way, the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel noted that those interrogation practices used against Abdat may constitute torture. And the Israeli Supreme Court has banned the use of family members to apply psychological pressure, which could amount to psychological torture. And then the European Union rejected Israel's attempt to use the dossier to cause it to end its support to the targeted groups. An EU spokesperson said that, quote, past allegations of the misuse of EU funds in relation to certain of our Palestinian civil society organization partners have not been substantiated. The EU will continue to stand by international law and support civil society organizations that have a role to play in promoting international law, human rights, and democratic values.
Given everything that you've just said, Marjorie, in your opinion, why hasn't the Biden administration criticized Israel for the terrorist designations and for the raids?
Well, Heidi, the Biden administration has followed in the footsteps of the prior U.S. administrations, Democrat and Republican, in uncritically supporting Israel to the tune of $3.8 billion a year in military assistance and the refusal to meaningfully criticize Israeli policies. In addition, the Biden administration, while mindful of the fact that the United States has refused to join the International Criminal Court, the Congress, this is interesting, the Senate, all 100 senators who can't agree on anything, all agreed to call on the International Criminal Court to prosecute Russia for its war crimes against Ukraine. So in the opinion of the Congress, and the U.S. administration shares that position, the International Criminal Court is competent to prosecute Russia, but not to prosecute Israel. And as I said, there is a formal investigation pending in the International Criminal Court of Israeli and Palestinians as well for war crimes, although to a much larger extent investigating Israel. And the Biden administration has criticized the International Criminal Court, saying that it's not competent to investigate Israeli leaders. And AIPAC, which is the leading Israel lobby in the United States, has a tremendous effect on the U.S. administration and most Congress members as well. And they apply tremendous pressure on the United States not to criticize Israel. So basically, when Israel says jump, the United States says how high?
In July, Joe Biden went to Jerusalem and pledged to, quote, stand with the Jewish and democratic state of Israel. Is Israel a democracy?
Well, Well, Israel's a democracy if you're Jewish, but not if you're Arab. Biden ignored the exclusion of the Palestinian people from Israel's so-called democracy, which protects only Jewish people. Palestinians do not enjoy the same democratic rights as Jews. And as Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem recently affirmed, Israel is an apartheid state.
During Biden's visit, the United States and Israel issued a joint declaration. What did that say?
In the Jerusalem U.S.-Israel Strategic Partnership Joint Declaration, the United States and Israel, quote, affirm that they will continue to work together to combat all efforts to boycott or delegitimize Israel, to deny its right to self-defense, or to unfairly single it out in any forum, including at the United Nations or the International Criminal Court, unquote. That means that the Biden administration commits to opposing the constitutionally protected boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, BDS, to affirming Israel's illegal claim of self-defense against Palestinians under its occupation, to stymieing the International Criminal Court's investigation of Israeli war crimes, and to voting against any criticism of Israel in the UN General Assembly. In the Jerusalem Declaration, Biden, on behalf of the United States, signed a, quote, commitment never to allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon and pledge that it is prepared to use all elements of its national power to ensure that outcome, unquote. When he was asked in an interview on Israeli television whether he would use military force against Iran, Biden ominously replied, quote, as a last resort, yes, unquote. And I should also say, Heidi, that while Biden was pledging allegiance to Israel, thousands of Palestinians in the Masafer Yatta region of the occupied West Bank faced imminent forced expulsions from their homes. Although this would violate the Geneva Conventions, Biden has not condemned it in spite of protests by U.S. Jewish organizations and 100 U.S. Congress members. And Biden would not meet with the people of Masafer Yatta or any other Palestinian community whose homes were threatened with demolition, which are funded by U.S. tax dollars.
The beloved Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was assassinated shortly before Biden's visit. How did the U.S. characterize this assassination?
Well, Abu Akleh was wearing a helmet and a vest labeled press, but she was shot below her ear, the only part of her face that was unprotected. And Shatha Hanaisha, who was another Al Jazeera journalist who also wore a helmet and vest marked press, said the soldiers, quote, did not stop firing even after Abu Akleh collapsed. The army was adamant on shooting to kill, unquote. A CNN forensic investigation cited explosive weapons expert Chris Cobb-Smith, who concluded that, quote, the number of strike marks on the tree where Abu Akleh was standing proves that this wasn't a random shot. She was targeted, unquote. And in a letter sent to Biden in advance of his visit, Abu Akleh's family charged that, quote, the United States has been skulking toward the erasure of any wrongdoing by Israeli forces, unquote. 2 weeks before the Israeli forces assassinated Abu Akleh, three leading Palestinian journalist organizations filed a complaint in the International Criminal Court that accused Israel of systematically targeting Palestinian journalists. But when Biden was there, he refused to meet with Abu Akleh's family. Basically, the U.S. government whitewashed Israel's assassination of Abu Akleh. And although the United States concluded she was likely killed by the Israeli military, the U.S. said it had no reason to believe that the killing was intentional, but rather the result of tragic circumstances, unquote.
Has Biden reversed illegal actions that Donald Trump took that uncritically supported Israel?
The answer to your question is no. Biden has not withdrawn Trump's illegal recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, nor has Biden rescinded Trump's declaration of the legitimacy of illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank, nor has Biden reopened the Palestinian mission in Washington.
How can our listeners follow your work?
Well, besides my regular gigs with you on Law and Disorder Radio, they can go to my website, marjoriecohn.com, and my regular Truth Out articles are posted on truthout.org.
Marjorie, thank you so much for this really informative interview and for all the work that you're doing in this area and many others.
Thanks so much, Heidi. I appreciate it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Is the most widespread form of censorship in the United States. That's when government officials, private individuals, or organizations remove books from libraries, school reading lists, or bookstores because they object to the content or the themes contained therein. Children's books are often the main targets. Complaints are typically that the book is sexually explicit, contains graphic violence, has offensive language, or shows disrespect for parents and family. Censors claim they're afraid the contents are dangerous for kids or that they'll cause young people to raise questions or incite critical inquiry that parents, political groups, or religious organizations deem inappropriate or just aren't ready to address. Before the 1970s, book bans typically focused on obscenity issues. Lady Chatterley's Lover by D.H. Lawrence and Ulysses by James Joyce were often banned. From the late 70s on, attacks focused more on ideologies. To Kill a Mockingbird, The Color Purple, The Catcher in the Rye, and even Harry Potter are among the 50 of the top banned books in this country. A new wave of book banning in public and school libraries is sweeping the nation in 2022. It's been underway since debates have percolated over critical race theory and what students should learn in the classroom. Several states are cutting funding for books written by authors in specific communities. Joining us to talk about book bans and free speech issues generally is Christopher Finan, Executive Director of the National Coalition Against Censorship. Chris previously served as president of the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression. That's the bookseller's voice in the fight against censorship. Before that, he was executive director of Media Coalition, a trade association that defends the First Amendment rights of producers and distributors of media. Christopher is the author of From the Palmer Raids to the Patriot Act, a history of the fight for free speech in America by Beacon Press, which won the 2008 Eli Obuler Award of the American Library Association. His forthcoming book is titled How Free Speech Saved Democracy. Christopher, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to start with a rather loaded question, but it will set the tone for our discussion. Chris, how important is freedom from censorship of books and speech to a democracy? And if you will, how dark a time are we facing, given an uptick in the banning of books and other forms of censorship?
Well, it's a really good question. And, you know, I think looking at free speech generally, and not just books, you know, to look back at the 19th century as a comparison with what free expression is considered to consist of today, it's, you know, it's like night and day. You know, in the 19th century, when everybody said they believed in free speech because there was a First Amendment, in fact, there was widespread censorship, and the people who took it in the neck the most were people who were fighting for equality. So abolitionists and suffragists and unionists, and they all faced government repression in continuing on into the 20th century and really, you know, through the 30s, although there was progress. But so, you know, in the broad scheme of things, the broad span of American history, we're certainly a heck of a lot better off now than we were then or even 50 years ago. But it doesn't mean that the threats that exist today aren't serious. I think having been in this business now for 40 years, that I can safely say that we haven't seen this much book banning since the 1980s. And in the 1980s, at the very beginning of what I think in retrospect is a culture war, you know, there were over 1,000 challenges to books in schools and school libraries around the country every year. We managed to get that down in the intervening period to maybe around 300 or 400 challenges a year. And mind you, these numbers are just based on reports to the American Library Association. You know, the actual number of challenges is probably a multiple of 2 or 3 times that many that just aren't reported. So, but there were 1,000 challenges a year in the early 80s. We're proceeding at a clip right now of about 5 challenges a day, between 5 and 10 challenges a day, according to ALA, which would put us very close to being really, you know, back in the soup that we were in the 1980s. So it's bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder, Chris, also, if you talk about speech codes on college campuses. They've been with us for a while, but they are changing too. Do you have any concerns over recent trends where such codes are concerned?
Well, actual legal codes, you know, the kind, there was a period in which a number of universities adopted, you know, formal legal codes. Those were largely held to be unconstitutional. There are still codes, you know, suggested conduct, but they are not the draconian codes that were introduced in the 90s. That said, you know, there's a lot of pressure. A lot of people feel that conservative speech. A lot of people on campus feel that students, particularly, that conservative speakers shouldn't be granted a venue and the legitimacy of speaking at a major institution. And, you know, this is sometimes characterized as cancel culture. So it's certainly something that that we have some concern about. That, you know, we work to try to talk about the importance of free speech to progressive values and to the achievement of greater democracy with young people. It's one of our challenges. But it certainly doesn't compare in any way in terms of to what's going on right now in efforts to suppress books in public schools and libraries.
Speaking of critical race theory and certain curricula and books being banned from the classroom, as you suggested, are these happening on any particular kind of college or university. Some have said it's sort of the more elite institutions. Have you seen a pattern about that? And what do you think accounts for an increase in crackdowns on faculty speech?
Well, I think, I'm not sure that, I mean, we certainly do hear about things when they happen at elite institutions, and but certainly there have been demonstrations at public institutions as well, and so I wouldn't know how to really weigh the differences there. The crackdowns that you're speaking about on what exactly are you, you know, referring to? Which kinds of?
We've heard reports of faculty members being reported onto the administration for what some students may call insensitive or offensive speech. And I believe there have been a number, you know, cases in the news that we've read about where either a faculty member has been discharged or punished by the administration in some fashion.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that is a serious problem. And I do believe that universities need to defend freedom of speech, particularly among faculty and to respect academic freedom. But that is certainly one of the hot topics right now on campuses.
I wonder too, in terms of book banning, in the broad sense, Chris, what is the current state of the law regarding the role of so-called community standards in fixing the constitutional limits on censorship and book banning?
Well, community standards is a concept that was introduced in the 70s, you know, by a conservative Supreme Court to presumably to make it easier for local communities to apply standards that might be narrower than metropolitan standards in defining, you know, what is what material is obscene and what isn't. So my organization, the National Coalition Against Censorship, was actually founded in the aftermath of the most recent Supreme Court decision on obscenity, and we were very concerned, you know, that this could lead to a great deal of censorship around the country, and there were a number of important court cases that were fought, and it ultimately hasn't had a great deal of impact on obscenity. Where it arises in the current controversy is there are claims by the people who are challenging these books that some of these books are obscene, which is frankly ridiculous. You know, these are books that have been selected by educational professionals because they feel that they address the needs of their students. These are not pornographers who are making these choices for our communities. And it's simply a matter of the greater explicitness of those materials in terms of just addressing issues of sex for kids is what is offending people. It's not that anybody is even claiming that these books are appeal to prurient interest, which is part of the test for obscenity. It's really just a way to pressure, you know, referring these complaints to prosecutors, which has happened on a couple of occasions, is just really an effort to put political pressure on the school boards to act. It's just, frankly, it's impossible to. There is, in fact, a separate standard for minors called harmful to minors, which is a variation of the test for adult obscenity. And as long as it has serious value for minors, it can't be obscene. And it would never be recommended for minors in schools if those educators didn't believe that it had serious value. So we think these are false claims.
I see. Chris, in light of the Supreme Court's ruling in Board of Ed, Island Trees Union Free School District versus PICO, where, of course, the court's opinion was narrow and applied only to removal of books supposedly from school libraries, does this nevertheless leave us in a dangerous situation where book banning is concerned?
PICO, there are only two real Supreme Court decisions that that protect free speech in schools. One is the Tinker decision, which allowed for non-disruptive protest by students that grew out of a protest against the war in the 60s, and the PICO case, as you mentioned. So we have to lean on those two cases. And PICO was decided by a plurality of the court. It wasn't even a majority opinion. So it's kind of a wobbly precedent, but we certainly refer to it. And it held that schools could not decide in the libraries, and this is different from curriculum. They could not exclude books based on their point of view. They could only bar books that were pervasively vulgar. So that's given quite a bit of protection to, at least theoretical protection to books in school libraries. Curriculum's another matter. The Supreme Court has given school districts local control greater, say over, what the books that are used in classes, in teaching.
Chris, I'm curious, do we see this book banning happening more or less equally on the high school as well as college levels?
I'd say it's far more pervasive in public schools, K through 12, than it is on college campuses. And this is because, there is because of the age of the kids that are involved, it appears to some people to be a greater threat to young people than it is to eight kids who are 18 and above.
The American Library Association, Chris, its Office for Intellectual Freedom, of course, documents censorship incidents around the country. But it also suggests strategies for dealing with those. What are some of the ways that can be countering to this growing trend?
Well, one of the things that we've depended on the most since the 80s is the adoption of written, detailed review policies by school districts. In the old days, before these policies existed, if a parent went in and complained to a principal or complained to a district superintendent about a book, it could just be pulled and at the discretion of that administrator, and nobody would be the wiser. And that was a real pressure point, a parent or a group of parents could really have a great deal of say over what everybody else's kid could read. So the review policies are generally call for the creation of a committee made up of a teacher or a librarian or some kind of school media person, sometimes a parent, often a parent, sometimes a kid, and they do the ridiculous thing of reading the whole book before they decide whether or not it should actually be banned or not. And you laugh, but it's like there was this case in Washington of a school board banned a book, and they got so much heat that they decided that they would read the book. They read the book, and they said, oh, of course, we shouldn't have banned this. But that's the first important safeguard, is that the committee reads the book. The committee then decides, whether it's appropriate at the grade level that it's been graded for. And in an overwhelming majority of these cases, the books go back on the shelves. And to some extent, that's happening now. The fear that we initially had was that school boards would fold under all the political pressure that's being applied. And many did. And they pulled not just one or two titles. They pulled whole lists of titles that were being circulated by conservative advocacy groups and politicians. And it was anybody's guess whether these books would ever, whether they would review these books as their policies required or not. And what we're seeing now is that, thankfully, a lot of these books are being returned, but a lot aren't. And so we're still confronted with really a small group of people, of, you know, activists and people who know how to use social media to make decisions about how not only their own kids read, but what other kids can read. And that's always our concern. And our feeling, you know, in all this, and whenever we're hit with the parental rights argument, is absolutely the parent has a right to decide for their own kid what he or she reads. But what they don't have is the right to decide for other people's kids, and that's the distinction that they're just not getting. You know, if it's not right for my kid, it's not right for anybody's kid, and that's where we really get wide-ranging censorship.
That's an important distinction. Thank you for that. Chris, what do you see as the most imperiled aspects of free speech these days? And I'm curious if the internet and social media has made threats more ubiquitous.
I don't think there's any doubt that social media has exposed a lot of things, a lot of hateful speech, and you know, people are rightly concerned about the threats about hate speech and about misinformation and disinformation. And I think it's safe to say that, you know, the lies about vaccines have cost lives. So it is a real danger, and I don't think any free speech advocate would argue that it isn't a problem. The problem with social media, though, is how do you distinguish what is dangerous speech from what is merely provocative speech, and who makes these decisions, and how are these decisions made, and do we want to go back to a world where the government makes these decisions? What are the responsibilities of social media companies? Where, you know, it's a very complicated issue that, you know, we're still trying to work out. So yeah, I certainly share a lot of the concerns of that have been expressed about social media, and we work on that to some extent. We have an arts advocacy program. We work with artists, we work with curators and museums, and, you know, trying to get the social media companies to respect their own guidelines for what material stays up and goes down is more than a full-time job. I mean, it's they have algorithms making decisions that are, you know, suppressing a lot of perfectly legitimate material. It is a real conundrum, and it'll take us considerable time to work it out.
Chris, though, before we run out of time, I want to make sure we give you a chance to let us know, when will your new book, How Free Speech Saved Democracy, it's called, be available? And how can our listeners follow you and the wonderful work of you and of your coalition?
Well, thanks. The book is really an effort to introduce people, because I think Americans aren't great history readers, to the role that free speech has played in our history in advancing equality by supporting the groups that I was talking about in the 19th century, and in this century, you know, being a real foundation under the civil rights movement that made it possible for the civil rights movement to survive the repression of state actors in the South. So it's going to come out. It's a short book, intentionally short. it's meant to be as accessible as possible so that kids can read it as well. It's from Steerforth Press. My friends, the independent booksellers, are, you know, will be glad to take orders as well.
Just wondered how our listeners can follow what you're doing and follow the coalition's work. Websites or whatever would be best.
Sorry, I was, you know, mostly focused on myself there. Our website is ncac.org, ncac.org, and you will find a plethora of the letters that we are writing now to school boards, trying to get them to maintain their to maintain their responsibilities under these review policies. And we also, you can follow us on social media, and we would love for that to happen.
Great.
Yes, it's just been a joy to talk to you today. Congratulations on your forthcoming book. I was lucky enough to read a small part of it. It's superb. Keep up the marvelous work with the coalition. It's timely, and you're doing a great job.
Yeah, and I admire the fact that it is a book that can be read by young people. That's where we have to do a lot of our educational, put a lot of our educational efforts in, of course. It's an accessible book. It's not just a book with, you know, thousands of footnotes and thousands of pages. It can serve a real purpose as an activist for free speech and why that is necessary to save our democracy.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you guys today, and maybe we can follow up, you know, down the road.
Yes, sure. We'd love to. We'll stay in touch. Thank you, Chris. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
WBAI New York. We're at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Good morning and thanks so much for tuning in. Law and Disorder, Mondays at 9 a.m. In the center of the FM dial, that's where our location is. And we have been here for 62 years bringing you programs like Law and Disorder. An incredible first half of the program, the interview with Marjorie Cohn. It's made possible because we have listeners just like you. So I want you to just take a moment right now before we move on with the rest of the morning's program to make a contribution in support of WBAI. Call our pledge line right now at 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Now, you could be driving on the Major Deegan, on the Van Wyck, on the Cross Bronx, or in Jersey on Route 17 or the Garden State Parkway or the Turnpike, the New Jersey Turnpike, picking up this signal. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we bring you this kind of radio, and it's made possible because of you. So again, the number is 212-209-2950. Make a contribution of any amount, whatever is comfortable for you. Make that call right now. 79 degrees currently here in New York City, going up to a high today of 85 degrees, and it's going to be warm over this next 24-hour plus period. So stay right with us right here at 99.5 WBAI. It's just about 10 a.m. here in New York, and I want to, you know, these things happen once a year, and I want to take this opportunity to